Hello and welcome to the Beyond podcast. And today we're doing another discussing episode in a slightly different way from usual. Often we have a very specific point to discuss or something to bring up or just throw around, or sometimes people are here to plug specifically an upcoming book or project. But this time we're just going to actually have a discussion. We're going to sort of do what it says on the tin for once. And we've got a starting point, which is playgoing in Elizabethan London, but we might veer off this. I'm quite content to see where this goes and see how it all flows and moves forward. So I have a guest with me who's going to discuss what they're up to and what they're interested in. Do tell the listeners at home, who are you and what is your purpose in life?
Hello. Hi, everybody. My name's Owen Price, and I work at Swansea University. I'm a theatre historian interested in early modern plays, perhaps especially the plays that are not by Shakespeare, which is handy for this purpose. I'm currently working on a project called Playgoing Time in Elizabethan London. So I'm particularly thinking about the Elizabethan period at the moment. And I suppose the basic principle of this project, it's quite a simple one, but I think it has kind of bigger ramifications, is that the way that you see a play in, well, this is true of anything, the way you see anything, but let's take it in our case, the way that an Elizabethan playgoer sees a play affects their understanding of the play. So, for example, somebody who is seeing the same play for the second, third, fourth time has a different reference point to somebody who's seeing it for the first time. The order in which people see plays affects the way they understand them. If you see a new play first and then you see an older play upon which the new play seemingly is based second, then that's a different sort of process to if you see it in this sort of expected chronological order. If you see lots of plays, then you have a different frame of reference to somebody who only goes to see plays occasionally. These kind of issues haven't really been discussed much in scholarship, not in a sustained way, because we tend overwhelmingly to think about a premiere and to think about a playgoer's first contact with a play. And we don't really have a methodology for thinking about all of the other stuff. And the reality is all of the other stuff is most of what there is, because only very occasionally do premieres take place. They're not taking place all the time. Once, twice a month, maybe there's a new play coming into the repertory. Most performances are repeats or revivals in some way, and yet we don't really properly acknowledge that. So I'm trying to think about what it might have been like to see plays. And to do that, I'm using the documents left to us by, well, not left to us, he didn't do it on purpose, but the documents that we have from Henslowe's account book, and particularly his daily box office takings, which give us an amazing insight into what was going on over a set of about 5 or 6 years. Mostly at the Rose Playhouse, very briefly at Newington Butts. And from that, we can actually see what's being played on a week-by-week basis. So we can start to think a little bit about, you know, what it might have been like if playgoers saw lots of those plays or very few of those plays and so on. So it's quite speculative, but we have to be speculative because we don't have enough evidence. But I think it's speculation that's based on what I think is a pretty solid assumption, and that is that no playgoer sees everything. That's not possible. You can't go to every single performance. That's just an impossibility. And we haven't, I think, sufficiently shaken that idea. And playgoers would see plays, I think, more than once. I think that is something that happened. I think the repertory almost encourages it at times. So those are some of the assumptions that I'm playing around with, and we'll see where it goes, I guess.
Well, yeah. I mean, it is one of the problems that we have when trying to conceptualize plays is, you know, the problem of lists. You know, as an administrator for Beyond, I have a list. It is mostly based on chronological order of putative premiere. But I have, if I was really good at, you know, computers designing things, I would design a list that the ebbs and flows, that you have that sort of initial point, but then it increase in brightness or decrease in brightness as to when it gets revived or not, or when it gets printed or not, because of course we also have to play hinterland of publishing. And of course the distortion we also have with publishing is, of course, what gets published is not necessarily to do with popularity of theatre, it's the popularity of what the printer thinks will sell. Yeah. So obviously there are some smash hits that clearly cross over between the two, where it's clearly a smash in the theatre and therefore it's going to be a smash in print. But then we have, I mean, going a bit earlier than Elizabethan play going, but you know, you look at all the morality plays and Tudor interludes that get published, and you're thinking, are they getting published because they are really representative of what was being performed, or are they being published because they're moralistic and therefore seem appropriate for print culture? And so we have all these gaps and these question marks about what's really popular. And also, what gets printed even within individual plays is, like, we know Tamburlaine, there is material in that that was theatrical but is not in the printed text, because the printer explicitly says, I cut the funny bits because I didn't think they were appropriate. So we have this through a glass darkly element that we can see all of those things. But the problem of the list and the problem of the data we have is so tricky.
Yeah, that's right. And we need those lists or we've got nothing. Mm. So without the list, you know, and without the texts that survive, and so we need that stuff. Mm. It's much better to have something than nothing. The question then, as you say, is what you do with it. And one of the things that Henslowe very helpfully shows us, as you said, is that very, very clearly, plays that were extremely popular in the theatre did not always go into print. Oh, and we, you know, Henslowe is probably the best example of that, because, you know, some of the plays that do best for him don't get printed. The Wise Man of Westchester, I think, is one of his biggest hits, based on how much money he takes, how much money he takes per performance, how often it's performed, whatever way you kind of want to cut it. It's a very, very successful play. And that's not making it into print. And there are other examples. So we know that there's not a kind of straightforward relationship between what ends up in print and therefore what survives to us and what was going on in the theatre. And we know that we're getting, and I guess the work on lost plays has shown us this as well, that we're getting, you know, a very incomplete picture because most plays are lost. And particularly as we go earlier, if you're looking at the 1570s and 1580, I mean, hardly any of it survives. Mm. And it's only really until you get a bit later when we start getting more texts. And that skews things because we don't quite know, you know, the more information you've got, the easier it is to be able to make determinations about what stuff was like. But as you say, you know, we don't know what we're missing. We might be missing a bunch of stuff that was generically very different to the stuff that survived. You know, there could be a, you know, genres out there, subgenres that we just don't really know about because it just hasn't registered in print in some way. And then, of course, there's the other issue, which is, as you said, how does the text relate to performance? And on the one hand, often not very uneasily anyway, because the texts aren't always, you know, according to what was performed. And Tamburlaine is an example of that. But also, how were they performed? And how were, you know, what were they like tonally, or, you know, what went on? We're trying to kind of, we're grasping a lot of that stuff. And again, we can recreate bits of it, I guess, because we can sort of identify certain actors playing certain roles and so on. But there's huge amounts that we don't really know. And I guess our job, it's not to not make assumptions, because I don't think you can not make assumptions, but it's to try and figure out what the best assumptions are, the safest assumptions, and to be aware that we're making assumptions and to be clear where we're making assumptions. I think that's kind of all we can do. And once we're in a position where we've got something that we're kind of happy with, that we feel is a fairly solid assumption, then we can start trying to do stuff. and I suppose that's partly what I'm thinking about in my current project. There are certain assumptions that I think we can make that are more secure than others, you know, and one assumption we can make is that, as I've said, playgoers are not going to be able to see everything. But actually, that's kind of an important point to make, because we can trick ourselves into thinking that we are grasping at something that was available to everybody in the early modern period, but it wasn't available to anybody. I mean, actually, nobody had everything. And even something like Henslowe's diary, that's not a publicly available document. That's not something that Elizabethan playgoers are seeing, certainly not in that kind of form. That's something that Henslowe has, which is amazingly useful. But we can look at that and think, oh, that's like a schedule. You know, as if you go on a website now and you could see, you know, that the list of plays being performed if we wanted to book at the National or something. Well, they didn't have that. So their understanding of things is partial also in ways that we've got to try and deal with and try and wrestle with. So in lots of ways, much fuller than ours. Mm. In some ways, slightly less full in some kind of weird ways.
Well, yeah, because in a sense, we can, you know, most theatres, you know, post what they're going to program, you know, seasonally. So you know in advance what's going to be on and you know when to book it. Whereas you only have a certain amount of notice as to what the repertoire is going to be. Yeah. And it's very reactive as well. They're clearly saying, well, the box office on that performance wasn't very good. When do we schedule it again? Do we schedule it again? Are we wanting to keep it in the repertoire so we can take it on tour? Because we think it will do well in the sticks. Do we think it will do well at court? So there's all these interesting programming questions as to what the incentives and disincentives are. And also sometimes, I suspect, same with modern producers to a degree, is there are plays that are financially horribly unsuccessful. The actors really like doing it. And so sometimes I suspect there are blips where there's a play that isn't performing brilliantly, but they're going, no, can we? They'll get it one day. They'll get it. They'll understand. Mm. And they might fight for it. One question I've never actually applied to Henslow, but it has been in my mind because I've been thinking about in the future when the potential of running essentially a repertoire in an early modern style, you know, as a pragmatic experiment, is the days of the week that performances are doing. Do plays repeat on the same day? Is it the idea that a playgoer might always go to the theatre on, you know, a Tuesday, mm-hmm. and that there's a guarantee that he's always going to see something new? Do they on some level design that, or is it entirely random? I've never got around to applying that because it's a job. But there's sort of that question in my mind, because if I was doing that today, I would design the turnover of plays, you know, every 2 weeks or so a new production, so that, you know, someone could always book on a Tuesday and always come and they'd always see a new play and they could watch the entire repertoire that way if they so desired. But then I'd probably also throw in the odd matinee, but, you know.
That's interesting. Yeah. That work can be done. I haven't done it. I'll probably have a look at that. My sense is, my feeling, there are different ways of viewing it. I mean, there's a question about how kind of organized and sort of programmed is the early modern repertory. Mm. And I tend to think that it's less programmed than maybe other people do. I think some people think that it's a very, very carefully calibrated sort of machine. And I think it's a bit more chaotic than that. I think they're definitely thinking about stuff. I think they're thinking about all of the stuff that you've mentioned, because you have to. And they're business people. If they get it wrong, then their livelihoods are on the line. But I think, for example, that in amongst all of the considerations that you've mentioned, they have to do something almost every day while they can. They're doing it 6 days a week in Henslow. There's some evidence that some companies are doing 7 days a week when they can. So your primary thing, you've got to put stuff on. And as you say, sometimes, you know, you're putting stuff on because actors might like it or whatever. You also might think, look, you've got to preserve your hits. You've got something that does well. You can't put it on. I mean, they don't put it on 7 days a week, but you couldn't really do that for very long anyway. Things might get stale. So there's a certain sense of you might have some kind of low-level duds in there because they're placeholders and they allow you to then maybe put on your bigger hits at premium times or whatever else it is. Or maybe it's the other way around. You put on, you know, big hits at times when people are kind of not going to the theatre as much, and you kind of slide in a little bit of a kind of not particularly, you know, successful play on a day when you know people are going to go and see it, because people are going to go to the theatre anyway. And there's a little bit of balancing that's kind of going on. But I don't know the answer to your question. I think it's an interesting one. And, you know, we could figure that out. Mm. And my suspicion is that it's slightly more chaotic and it would be, but I don't know. And it may be that there's something like that going on.
Well, it is one of the problems is talking about Elizabethan theatre, you know, because Elizabeth lived quite a long time. And so there's quite a dynamic range between what's happening at the beginning of her reign and what's happening at the end. Yeah. And I think there's an awful lot of chaos and there's an awful lot of just doing. Because the other thing is, you know, sometimes plays will probably get put on because it needs a slightly smaller cast and some people are a bit ill that day, that there are some last minute substitutions as well, that you have a backup play, you know, because, you know, some plays are obviously very actor heavy and actor intense. And, you know, we tend to think sort of later on in the period, you know, some of the star vehicles that are turning up, Well, the star can't star in every single show. He's got to have a quiet day.
Yeah.
Because there's the old, joke about actors resting. But it is a thing, actually. Mm-hmm. You're performing intense parts. Mm-hmm. You actually do need some time off occasionally to
And we can see that in Henslow. Holger Syme has shown this. But you look at something like Tamburlaine and the Battle of Alcazar. And it's not quite clear. The Battle of Alcazar may or may not be listed as a play called Mahomet in Henslow's diary. It's not clear. But what seems to sometimes happen is that you get Alan in the role of Tamburlaine, which is a massive role. He's in almost all of the scenes. He's constantly talking. He kind of, he's all over that play. And then he plays a sort of notionally similar-ish kind of role. Well, actually, it's quite a different role. But anyway, he plays a much smaller role as the key point in something like the Battle of Alcazar. And there are times where the two are going next to each other. And it's that sense of preserving the actor, which, you burn them out. And people like David Garrick burned out. And I don't think it's necessarily even strictly related to the number of lines, although that's one way of doing it. It could be if it's a very athletic role or it's very demanding. Maybe it's emotionally demanding in some way. I don't know. But I think those are definitely considerations, and I think you're weighing that up as well. And I guess you've probably got to try and address all of those things. But you have to protect your actors; they'll be burned out otherwise. And you've got to think about contingencies. I think that's absolutely right. You are, of course, thinking about your audience. What do they want? What can you give them? You're trying to give them new things, but you're also trying to reuse old things. There's a sense in which the way that the repertory is structured, new plays make old plays new. You put on, every time you introduce a new play into the repertory, you expand the range of associations and reference points for the old plays that you put on. And so that you can go to an old play and then view it through the lens of the new play. So there's a sense in which it's, to a certain extent, I think, meant to be a kind of self-renewing sort of system, which encourages repeat play going as well. Because I don't think that they can survive as they do, because they think London's big enough at this point, and I think that they're doing too many plays, or rather they're playing too often, if people aren't going to come back to see a play more than once. I think that has to be a bigger thing, I would think, than it is, say, now, where I very, very rarely get an opportunity to see a play, the same production more than once. I might see the same play many times, but it's very rare in my life that I've been able to see the same production more than once, without I've been particularly inclined to, because of the way that we stage things.
But maybe that's our problem with the way we produce at least drama. I mean, I think when it comes to, say, musicals, there's definitely people who will go to see the same musical more than once. Mm-hmm. And also, in terms of our other entertainments, watching the same film more than once, watching the same program more than once. So we do consume certain media more than one still today, but because we have a much more variated, certainly in terms of the way theatre is produced, we don't really have companies that do the same kind of revivals of plays. It's always, especially when they're doing old plays, the thing that sells it is actually it's a new production of an old play. So they don't essentially recycle the show from last year, because actually the audience for that has probably already been burnt out.
Yeah. And I think this is a thing about sort of that model, if you like. There's a weird thing as scholars, most of the scholars working in this kind of area are from the UK or the US or Canada and so on, where the model that is dominant in theatre is the kind of West End Broadway type thing, isn't it? Mm. And obviously repertory theatre takes place elsewhere, but there's this weird sort of double thing where we know that the early modern repertory involves playing a different play every day. And we know that. And yet somehow in this strange way, when we actually come to write about it very often, we do so as if it's a sort of kind of West End Broadway kind of model, which so there's a weird, and that's what I'm trying to kind of get back to. What is it actually like to see these plays in this kind of, given that what we know about the way that they're performed? And I think one of those things is that they're seeing them more often. Maybe there are some playgoers who only go to a play on a Tuesday, and maybe they can see really quite a lot of plays in that way. But maybe they go to a Tuesday one week and they go to Thursday one week and so on. And you don't necessarily, it's not entirely clear how much warning you're getting before you're going in. And they're certainly not, as you would now, booking well in advance, yeah, knowing that you're going to see, you know, Sejanus or whatever it is that you're that you're going to see. That's not what they're doing. Mm. So, yeah, maybe they're going to see a player not knowing what it is until they're there. That seems a weird possibility in a way that just seems completely inimical to the way, certainly the way that I would go to see a play. Now I know what I'm going to see if I'm going to see something at, I don't know, the National or wherever. Mm. You know, I'm not just turning up. I'm sure there are people who do that, but I think there's much more of that in this sort of early modern context.
Yeah, and that's perhaps where genre plays its part as well, in the sense that you may not know what the play is, but if you know that they're doing a comedy or a tragedy or a history, or as Elizabethan theatre progresses, all these additional potential subgenres and the fluidity of genre. I mean, genre, as we know it today, sort of comes from a competitive marketplace. You didn't need genre before the sort of the mid 16th century, because you would have drama, but that was the drama that was happening in that locality. You didn't have competition at the same time in the same way. So you need genre to tell people in a shorthand what they're going to see, as opposed to what they're going to see further down the road.
Yeah.
So as we progress through, you know, into the late 16th century, we get this explosion of potential ways of selling plays. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And how do you sell plays to an audience? And, you know, what is the advertising text like? What is the word on the street for these things? You know, we know that they're plastering up play titles and play information, but we don't necessarily know precisely what that information is.
Yeah. That's absolutely right. In fact, actually, this is a plug now that you mention it, because I'm doing a research and action workshop at the Globe on, I think, the 17th of May. I may have got that date wrong. And it's about this kind of thing. It's about what, how are plays framed, and how does the framing of a play potentially affect the way a playgoer understands the play, or what kind of prejudices or you know, preconceptions the playgoers bring with them based on whatever bits and pieces they've seen going in. Mm. So we'll attempt to think about that in that workshop. But I think that's right. You are going to bring things with you, and even if you are going in and you don't really know much about it, very quickly you're told things. And if you're an experienced playgoer, if you've been to see some plays, then you pick up on that stuff right away, because it tells you in different ways the way that actors talk, the way that they stand, the kind of words that they use. All of those kinds of things are telling you, giving you generic markers, which the play will either sort of endorse. It looks like it's a comedy. Look, it turns out to be a comedy. Or will then subvert. You think you're in a comedy. Actually, here's the tragedy or whatever it is. And I think playgoers are alert to that sort of stuff. And I mean, you know, this from the performances that you've been doing, and from the response of the people who've been in those performances, that, you know, you pick up stuff, even if you don't remember titles, and even if you don't remember, you know, every aspect of a plot or something, you know, you remember bits and pieces, set pieces, kinds of, you know, ways of speaking, whatever else it is. Those are things that you kind of have in your memory, and that playgoers surely had in their memories too. Very few people are ever going to kind of remember a sort of play in anything like its sort of entirety. It's bits and pieces, isn't it? It's, you know, maybe character names or particular things or something that an actor did. That stuff is what kind of sticks. And I think that's the stuff that playgoers enjoy and remember and take with them. And they carry then that with them into another production. You know, like something like Tamburlaine clearly has a big effect, but people aren't going into later plays with the entire kind of Tamburlaine in their head. You know, they're going in with bits of Tamburlaine, a spectacle or a sense of whatever it is. Like, it'll be different from one individual to the next, but it's never like the entirety of the text. In the way that, not that we, obviously nobody thinks that that's what Plato is, but it's easy to trick ourselves, because we've got these texts and because we can read them, and because we have to study them, that that's what people kind of remembered or felt. And it's not, is it? It's unlikely to be. That's not how performance works, really.
Yeah, it's the Friends title principle, isn't it? It's the one with that you remember. And I mean, there are obviously ones that you remember more because they're also referenced in other plays or picked up upon. I mean, the reason why Spanish tragedy has such a lengthy sort of hinterland is, A, it's constantly revived, but also people are constantly referring to it and doing callbacks. And callbacks is one of those things that adds to the audience experience, is, you know, it's that bit from... And I suspect with something like Spanish tragedy, that it's like that television program that everybody's talked about, but you've never actually watched, but you know all about it because everybody else has been talking about it. So even if you've never seen the Spanish tragedy, you might know what happens in the Spanish tragedy.
Yeah.
And so you can still reference what's going on. And Tamburlaine's probably the same. And of course, because they're also getting printed as well, as time goes on, it becomes there's an additional experience that people can become weirdly obsessed with certain plays. I mean, the sort of hinterland of Cambyses as well, which is a play full of images. I wonder if that's actually, some of these plays are successful not because of the language or the words or the stuff that we're looking at. It's actually the images that you know, that are sticking with people and going, oh God, do you remember that bit? In a way that, you know, the yes, playwrights may be quoting lines or a thing, but that's playwrights do.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that's absolutely right. I mean, the way Edward Allan walked on stage in some of his roles was one of the things that people remembered most about the plays that they saw. So I think it's absolutely, that's going to be absolutely, absolutely right. I think I don't think there's any doubt about that. But I think what you said about, you know, the Spanish tragedy, I think is also absolutely right. There are things I think I might have seen maybe one episode of Game of Thrones. I know what Game of Thrones is. I get it. I've seen bits and, you know, do you know what I mean? I know that series, even though I've not watched it. I know it kind of well. I could get jokes about it. I get people when they make jokes about it. I don't think
anyone's watched Game of Thrones. I think a lot of people in the media have watched Game of Thrones and assumed that actually it's hugely successful. But I don't actually, certainly in the UK, I don't think anyone's really watched it.
That's interesting as well. That is interesting. There's that weird sense that some things have a sort of bigger effect than... Yeah, and I think possibly those kinds of things happened in the early modern period too. You know, these plays are weirdly, the repertory again is quite weird in the way that it works, because on the one hand it makes it very likely that you will see a play more than once, because it's not like a block, and if you miss it in that block it's off. They're coming back and they'll go away and they'll come back, and we can see from Henslowe he'll happily take a play out for a year and then bring it back, or 2 years even. They're not necessarily done. They'll keep coming back in different forms. So there's always a chance you might see it again at a later date. And because of the way that they seem to be done in this sort of slightly more kind of sporadic way, you can see them over quite a lengthy period of time. You know, a single run might last several months. On the other hand, early modern plays are extremely easy to miss for precisely the same reason. You might have a first run of 6 or 7 performances over a couple of months. Well, that's very easy to miss. And there's this weird, so there's something really quite interesting and weird going on about the repertory that I don't think we've fully kind of wrestled with. And it's that sort of, it's dual capacity to serve you up the same things multiple times or something different every time. And the possibility that some things will, a little bit like what we're starting to get now with Netflix, you know, Netflix spending all this money on shows, it not quite going right, and then shelving them. And now we're getting to a point where we're going to have shows that just disappear again. And you won't be able to see, because many of us are kind of accustomed to this idea of being able to watch sort of what we want when we want on TV. And even things that disappear, well, sometimes that, you know, sometimes Netflix takes something off, but then it'll go on a different platform or whatever. But we're faced with the possibility, and it's already happening, I think, of some shows disappearing.
Yeah.
And that happened in the repertory. You know, you might have liked to play, didn't do well enough, it disappears. Or the company that had it stopped doing it, or they go somewhere else, and it's gone.
There's an irony with iPlayer and BBC Sounds, you know, when it puts something up for a month or 2 months or 3 months, that it means I'm less likely to watch it. because it's on there. And then, of course, by the time I get around to watching it, it's gone.
Yeah.
And I wonder if there's a sort of slight parallel there. It's just, you know, I'll catch it the next time it comes around, and then you never do.
Yeah, and it seems to be quite volatile. I don't think it's going to be clear always which plays are going to stick and how they're going to stick. I mean, I can't remember the exact figures, but there's a play called Bellendon, which is a lost play, but a sort of highwayman figure. And it does well, basically, in Hensersdale. It seems to do pretty well. But you look at how often it's performed. I can't remember what the stake, but let's say it's 20 times. 20 times in a year is a lot in Henslow. But that's not a lot, really, is it? You know, when you consider 20 performances scattered over several months, that's kind of missable. And, you know, if you get 20 performances in a year, that's a play that's done pretty well to get that far. That might be it, and it might go for a while, or it might have some more. But that's, you know, you could feasibly not see that. And some of these things we're thinking about as being big hits, because that's what that's what Henslow's diary is telling us. It's saying, well, it was put on a certain number of times, or it made a certain amount of money. But there are presumably people who just keep missing these plays, and they're not quite seeing them. They might know about them, or they've seen similar things, but they're not seeing this thing. And I think that it's as daft as it kind of, it sounds sort of absurd. People, you know, there are people who didn't see the Spanish tragedy because it's got such a big cultural, I think, yeah, you know, maybe that's right. Maybe there are a bunch of people who didn't really see Tamburlaine or whatever, or they know about it. I think there's a difference between the idea. I don't find it that credible to think that if you're a playgoer, you don't know what Tamburlaine is, or you don't know what Spanish tragedy is, even decades later, because I think they're reference points. I think that's, you know, maybe there's a point in time where they stop being reference points so much. But I find that, you know, very credible to think that playgoers know about this stuff. But whether they actually saw them, or whether, you know, that seems slightly less secure than we might think. And we've got to do this odd thing where we've got to sort of rely on the data that we've got, because what else do we do? While also knowing that the data doesn't fix everything. So you get a load of accounts that say, Tamburlaine was great. We all love Tamburlaine. Tamburlaine brilliant. Oh, Tamburlaine was scary. Oh, Tamburlaine was this and that. It doesn't, what we can't see are the people who aren't talking about Tamburlaine, who don't really care, who just thought Tamburlaine didn't
I don't do that. I go for the comedy. Some people, you know, fit into that. There's sort of that parallel. The other question, you know, with smaller spaces that aren't performing as often, so Boys Company, you know, where you think that Lily has this interesting effect on writing and has a sort of cultural effect that is possibly massively out of proportion with the number of people who actually saw the plays.
Yeah.
Whereas, you know, you can say reasonably that Spanish tragedy, you know, was seen by a lot of people, as well as being printed and therefore read by a lot of people. Whereas plays which were mostly seen in smaller spaces and less often, potentially, have a different cultural effect on who's going to those plays as well, and who's paying what and to see what and where. Complicates it, you know. What counts as a good night out or afternoon out? And there's stuff that's sort of going on around that as well.
Yeah. And when we go later in time and we start seeing bits and pieces of sort of playgoing diaries, they're often extremely unhelpful, because it'll just be somebody, it's like Bulstrode Whitlock, he just says play. You know, 12th of February, play, you know. 18th of February, play. You know, what does that mean? And is that suggesting that it didn't really matter? He was just going to see the performer. Like, he doesn't know what the, you know, is that, you know, what's going on there? And how do you then read that? Is that meaningful? In other words, he's deliberately, what he's interested in is that he went to see a play and it doesn't matter what he saw, because the performance and the experience of being there was what was interesting. Or is it just that's just how he, you know, he just wanted to record that he'd seen a play? And, you know, how meaningful is that? Do you see what I mean? Like, we on the one hand, we could say, ah, well, this shows that play titles didn't really matter. Actually, playgoers, we could do that, and maybe there's a bit of that that's true. But maybe it's just the bloke who that's just how he was listing things in his sort of financial accounts, because he's listing what he went to see, in the same way that he doesn't say dinner and then say what it was that he got. You know, he's just recording. And yeah, it, you know, we've got these bits and pieces of sort of information much later on from these people. And it doesn't, it's then quite tricky to know what to do with it. We've got less from the Elizabethan period, but even the bits that we've got there are really interesting. I mean, I'm interested in John Chamberlain's account of seeing the Comedy of Humours, which again, we know from Henslowe is one of his big hits. It's a bit of a sensation. Chamberlain talks about it being a bit of a sensation, but he didn't like it. He didn't get it. He didn't hate it. He just thought, don't get what the fuss was about. And there's something interesting about all of the evidence that we've got pointing towards this being a massive play, even a bit of a game changer, maybe sort of the first kind of really clear articulation of the Comedy of Humours, not even necessarily the first humour or comedy, because we can, but a really clear early kind of precursor to what Jonson's going to do, and which is going to shape comedy for subsequent periods.
Yes, we have literally just finished reading through quite a lot of Humour's plays.
Yeah, and the only eyewitness is saying, "Don't get it. What was all that about?"
I might say we might have one or two people in our room who would agree with that opinion.
I think we have a lot of people who'd agree now, and I think there's an interesting question to be had there about why it is that, which has possibly taken us in a different direction. Mm. But I think that there's something interesting going on there, because I think there are things that are very popular now or get well regarded now, which I think are sort of a little bit like doing something for the role that the humoral comedy did in the 16th and 17th century, but we don't think about those things as being connected. And the example I would probably give is something like Succession, which people want to read as shit, partly because it wants to be read in that way. But actually, if you think about people tricking each other, being complete arseholes, can I say that? Sorry, to each
yes,
other.
Yeah.
People, the way that people talk to each other, those kinds of rivalries, all that sort of stuff, that sense of the different personalities clashing together that and the different sort of priorities, that's not dissimilar to sort of the notion of what humoral comedy is kind of doing. So I think, but on the other hand, humoral comedy is clearly emerging out of a particular set of contexts that are sort of partly or largely lost to us. And
yes,
so things that, those reference points are not connecting in the way that they might do.
Yes, I mean, it helps that, our initial explorations are reasonably comprehensive in the sense that most people will have done most of the texts, if not all of the texts. So it's probably more... seen more drama than maybe the average playgoer at the time might have seen. But comedy based on references, even if we're getting the references, doesn't always work. Sometimes it does. But also comedy just ages generally very badly because it's idiomatic. It's the way you tell it. So you could say structurally this gag is fine,
yeah,
but the way you're telling it is so alien to us that it doesn't land. Mm-hmm. And usually, unfortunately, with certainly most Comedy of Humours and most comedies of the late Elizabethan, the sort of underlying unremitting misogyny means it's very difficult to do anything with these texts, because with a comedy, you can argue this point, but broadly speaking, the audience have to laugh and find it funny and enjoy it, and if the audience inherently doesn't, we can't make a modern audience.
Yeah.
Like these opinions or like these or find these things funny. Whereas the advantage with tragedy is all of the assholes die, usually. And it's not inherently a problem that they die. And you could always kill off a few more people at the end as well. Nobody would mind.
Yeah.
So the audience response is fundamentally different.
Yeah.
So you could, but I think there's a similarity with modern comedy as well. You think of the comedies 20 years ago. 20, yeah. 30 years ago, that are not that old, but have aged fantastically badly.
Yeah.
And you're going, ooh, can't find that funny anymore.
Yeah. Yeah.
Why did we find that funny then? Mm-hmm. So it's sort of the thing. Yeah, we do everything.
Yeah.
But it's quite difficult to do some of it in a way that's not a tragedy.
Yeah, and I think
we can do comedy as tragedy, but we can't do it as comedy.
It's a big, and it is often a way that those plays get done, isn't it? And to a certain extent, they're permissive to it. To a certain extent, they open the door to it, don't they? Mm. But yeah, I think there is a kind of, there are fundamental difficulties and questions to ask about you know, what it is that we choose to do and why. And I got used to get asked this question a lot about, what plays would you like to see performed or whatever. And it's a very difficult one to sort of answer. And I there was one point, you know, where I just thought, oh, you know, do everything, all the rest of it. But one, that's obviously very difficult to do, to get, you're asking people to, you know, that's a big commitment. And, you know, there are questions about which plays should we revive, you know, are some plays more worthy of revival than others? Are there some of these things in the past we maybe don't want to do, you know, right, in terms of like full scale professional stuff because people won't like them because maybe they're not there. There's this sense that I guess what I'm trying to say, and I think with comedy, with humor or comedy, I think the points that you make are right. I think it's not even so much that the plays are kind of bad, but you also have bad plays in the period. Some of these plays are not very good. And there's a critical difficulty with acknowledging that when you're trying to sort of, you know, get people excited and you're trying to sort of revive attention in things that are forgotten and some of them should be forgotten.
Yeah, I mean, at our phase, it's always the question I'm asking in the room, you know, what is the best face for this text? What is the best production we could make out of this? What spin can we give it? What can we do to give it its best face? Mm-hmm. And then once we've done that, we can present it to an audience and see how, and let the audience to a degree decide. Mm-hmm. And some of these texts are then sort of categorized into, well, this is a educational experience rather than something that we're talking about putting in a repertoire.
Exactly.
You know, we will stage it with some, context, with introductions or maybe even commission a response piece to it as a conversation within a framework. So it's a matter of, you know, we know the ones that are really good, by and large. We know the ones we think are probably quite good. But then there's a big area of texts that have something, mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. but it's a matter we have to do the work to find out how to make them good. And I could give you lots of examples of other plays that we can't talk about where that work's been done at great length to make plays that are not necessarily great.
Yes,
that have great bits, but are not overall great plays.
So the other thing about that is that that other writer that we can't talk about has a sort of distorting effect because that people expect to encounter that kind of play and they're encountering a totally different kind of play. And it just doesn't work by those rules. And I think this is part of the issue with Ben Jonson. Mm. I, you know, some people just don't like Ben Jonson. That's fine. Yep. Not everyone. But he isn't the other guy. You know, he's not, and if you try and make him, it just doesn't work. It just absolutely, it can't be viewed in those terms. It's not wanting to, it's not really amenable to it, certainly not the comedies anyway. And sometimes that's the problem. And well, if it is, it's definitely a problem, but that's a kind of issue where we're sometimes getting plays by whoever it is. Jonson's actually a good example, but it could apply to a lot. It doesn't apply so much to tragedies, I think, and it doesn't apply so much to something like, you know, Webster's tragedies, say, where we've got an available model that we understand and we like for working with those plays. So they're not issues. But there's a big bunch of other stuff. Fletcher's plays would be one. I mean, Fletcher, although he's a collaborator, he's not really doing what the other guy does.
Well, it's like all those sort of early-ish Elizabethan dramas. You know, they're doing a very different job of work.
Yeah.
You know, Green Kid, etc. They're all doing a very different kind of play. And that's because they're doing a different kind of play. I mean, the problem that Jonson faces, I think, which is slightly different to the others, is the others are writing relatively straightforward narratives that are, you know, have punch and impact and they have a certain punk quality to them. That's what I feel about the sort of mid Elizabethan phase. Mm. When you get to sort of that later into Jacobean, the stuff that Jonson's doing, partly because, of course, we have the distortion of how Jonson texts come to us in this expanded form.
Yeah.
People see this block of text that is clearly too long, and some of which is not necessarily designed for the stage, and say, well, that doesn't work. And well, we've got to cut it.
Yeah.
And there's lots of ways of cutting this cloth. And this is my constant battle, frankly, in the reading room, which is to say, no, you have to make an imaginative leap with this text. Too much text is not a problem because we invented blue pencils. So we could, how do we cut the cloth of this text? I mean, it's more of a Jacobean problem than it is Elizabethan problem of text being too long. Mm-hmm. Elizabethan plays, as they come to us, tend to be, if anything, too short, or more to the median length that we sort of expect, around 20,000 words or so. So they're very different products as well. The texts that come to us from Elizabethan drama is so varied in tone, length, yeah. shape. Yeah. Yeah. And also just sort of editorial policy of how do you print a play. These things become a lot more standardised once people have figured out what they think the market wants and also what the authors want, because the authors are going, well, I think I'd like to present my version of the play, and yeah. that becomes more of a problem later on.
Yeah, yeah, that's right. And there are whole sort of genres, really, that are not like the stuff that the other guy does. Mm. And you don't get to see them performed. And if you do, there's a good chance that you'll see them performed as if it was a, you know, that the frame of reference would be Shakespeare. And that's not helpful, particularly with those where he's not really starting out when some of those plays are being written. But they're not trying to do that. And you're going to really struggle, I think, if you can't unfix those things, because a whole bunch of stuff is just going to be judged on the wrong terms. And I think you can, I suspect if a lot of people saw some of this, you know, a lot of people would not get it, and that's fine. Mm. But I think if it's to be done, it kind of has to be done in a way that acknowledges it on its own terms. And that's partly difficult because we're trying to figure out what are those terms, you know, what are they? Yeah. It's not entirely clear all the time.
Yeah, and you know, sometimes the terms of reference shift anyway, because we've got different companies have a different style or a different idea of what plays. They have a different size company, they have a different repertoire structure. And yeah, so that's why there's this sort of, our current name is, you know, this maximalist approach of sort of throwing as many texts together, roughly chronologically at the moment, and letting them find their own level and building an audience that is there for that. I mean, that's actually, in a sense, the primary aim of what I'm trying to do at the moment is to build the audience, because there's no point staging things if there's no one coming. No. And, you know, to do this kind of scale of drama, you know, I could do early Tudor stuff till the end of time, because you only need about half a dozen people, and, you know, you only need a relatively small audience base for that to work. But if we're doing plays with 8, 12, 16 actors, you need an audience base, and we don't have that yet. And it's a matter of sort of essentially building that audience and saying explicitly, we're not doing that.
Yes.
That is not our frame of reference. You know, we're not here to be, you know, mean about the other guy, but we have to throw him out the room because it just sucks all the oxygen out in ways that are really unhelpful.
Yeah. And maybe there's a point in, once some of that stuff's been done, if that were ever achieved, that you can sort of bring them back in again, but you can't, like, if he's just going to come in and overwhelm everything, you're done. You're absolutely done.
In terms of box office maths, it inevitably skews everything.
And
makes playing everything else not fun. That's the other problem.
I'm
just going to go back to Henslowe. Just a question about, and I know the answer to this is basically, we don't know. On that speculative basis, are we being skewed in our idea of repertoire of other theatres and by Henslowe? Do we know whether other theatre companies were as active? Did they perform as often? Did certain theatre spaces use their spaces for different things in between shows? You know, how do we think that that's actually a fair representation of how busy everyone was? We've got a reasonable idea that the boys' companies had a less of a turnover, but, you know, other commercial touring players, what sort of ideas do we have on that?
Well, like you say, there's a lot that we don't know. What we know is that there are sort of more playing spaces sort of than playing companies. Mm. So that there are spaces that are sort of presumably either fallow, there's nothing in them, or they're doing other things, or there's something else that we're missing. But that, you know, and one of the things that happens in Henslowe is that they go to Newington Butts, you know, which is a totally different playhouse for 9 days or whatever it is. So odd things are happening. I think in the Elizabethan period, it is odder in lots of ways. As theatre as a sort of business becomes a little bit more stable, though it's a very precarious business. And, you know, playwrights, for example, are often getting in trouble with debtors and going to debtors' prison and so on. It's pretty, you know, it's pretty precarious in all kinds of ways. But as it becomes more sort of stable and you get into, say, especially in the Caroline period, you get a lot of stability. So in the 1630s, say, the king's men have a big back catalogue potentially of 30 odd years. And you can do that thing of going back and we'll do a play from 1600 or something. Although you've got playing kind of regular play, I don't know quite how to describe it, professional inverted commas, but although you've got outdoor playhouse performance in London from, say, at least 1567 with the Red Lion, and certainly by the mid-1570s with the curtain and the theatre, you've got a lot of flux, and there's a lot of uncertainty about what exactly is happening, what the companies are. There's a lot of changeover. Where companies are playing, things aren't really getting fixed. And although, say, in Henslow in 1590, theoretically, you've got 20-odd years of plays to draw on, that doesn't seem to be what's happening. The oldest plays in Henslow, I think, so far as you can tell, are about, well, they're sort of late 1580s plays. So something like The Jew of Malta or Dr. Faustus or Tamburlaine, you know, those would be about as early as it seems that the companies in Henslow's diary are performing plays. So if you're in 1597, that means a 10-year-old play is about as old as it gets. Mm. In the 1630s, an old play could be 30 years old, could be 40 years old. So, you know, there are those kinds of differences. The Elizabethan period is less fixed, less nailed down than, I think, later periods. And so it's perhaps harder to sort of make determinations. And there are odd things happening in Henslow. But without wanting to be too sort of fixed, I think it gives us an impression of how a theatre entrepreneur might kind of manage a business. And it gives us a sort of model which sort of isn't crystal clear but seems kind of feasible and seems to sort of tie in with whatever it is that we know about repertory playing kind of elsewhere. So in other words, key things that we're getting from Henslow: how often plays are coming into the repertory, how often they're playing in outdoor playhouses, those sorts of things do, you know, they seem plausible. That seems likely that other people would do that. As for specifics, that's, you know, how much of this is idiosyncratic, and how much of it is idiosyncratic practice to the companies that are putting on the plays, you know, to the Admiral's men, say, or whoever, how much of it is idiosyncratic practice to Henslow in terms of his note-taking and so on. Those kinds of things, I think, are harder to say. I think it gives us an idea. I mean, what it really gives us is an idea about how, what's going on at the Rose. That's what it does, doesn't it? And with those particular companies, I think there's a certain amount of extrapolation that can be carefully done from that, but it has to be careful, is what I would say. So slightly hedging bets, but I think basic sort of practices, I think, ring true. But there's lots that we don't know.
Yeah. I mean, it was interesting making the point that you don't have particularly old plays, and I suspect that's probably because there's such a shift in playing company structure. You know, the number of actors you have in plays, you know, and the number of small, the sort of the leftover rump of the sort of interlude tradition of, you know, relatively small companies bobbing about everywhere, which gets sort of collided together in the 1580s. You know, certainly after the Queen's Men, the companies just get larger. The old playing stock isn't usable, actually. That they've got to, and there's a lot of freewheeling going on. I mean, it's interesting. Other thought is that, in a sense, no playing company ever appears out of one of the problems we always have with trying to recreate early modern conditions is we're always having to create a company from scratch. And, of course, that never happened. In fact, I don't think there's a genesis for any, meaningful genesis for any company, in the sense that a company, all the companies we sort of know about are combined bits from previous companies who bring their own previous repertoire with them. So it's not like everyone just turned up on day one and said, hello, we are now a theatre company. Here are the new plays we're working with. No, it's, I need to integrate you into this player, you integrate into my play, and back and forth. And there's all these collisions going on in the throughout Elizabeth's reign where new is coming out of the old. And that's sort of one of the things I'd like to do in the long term is to, you know, start with the earlier tradition as much as we've got, building a, you know, repertoire with the small plays and the smaller plays, and then trying to collide an experience base with the few 1570s and 80s plays that we have. The gaps there are annoying.
And the other thing that we don't really know about is how loyal were playgoers? Are there playgoers and they'll basically only go to the Rose? Are there playgoers and they'll go to the Rose and the theatre or whatever, you know, and they'll divide their time? And how does that work?
Yeah.
And of course, the thinner you spread yourself, the more likely you are to miss things. If you're spending part of your time north of the river at you know, the theatre or the curtain or whatever, and part of your time in the Rose, then you're even less likely to get the full picture of the different repertories that are being played by the different companies at those spaces. Mm. And, you know, we do know that there are playgoers who go to more than one playhouse, but how normative is that? Is that what most people who go to plays do? Or do most people who go to plays stick at a certain place? I mean, there are certain places where we assume that playgoers, so for something like the Red Bull in the early 17th century onwards, there's an assumption that people who go to the Red Bull only go to the Red Bull. It's probably an assumption that could be troubled a bit. But, you know, that's a kind of, there's an association. But with other places like, say, the Rose, it's not at all clear to me whether there's a big bunch of people and that's what they go to see, or whether they're kind of mixing and matching. And what that means then is if you're at the Rose, the big bunch of plays, say, you might not see a big bunch of these other plays because they're somewhere else. You know, so again, there are weird things going on with the way that with our understanding of how people understood plays, which, as I say, tends to be this kind of weird, impossible idea that they got it all. But they won't have got it all. That's absolutely, completely impossible. Nobody's doing that. In the same way that I can't watch everything that's on Netflix now. I'd be dead, you know, I'd be there for hundreds of years. It's too much stuff. And it's not that amount of stuff at this time, but realistically, feasibly, if you've got a couple of different companies at different places in London and you're one person and you've got a certain amount of money and a certain amount of time, you're picking and choosing, and you're not actually going to be able to see it all. And you don't have to, in the sense, as you said earlier, that you see one play and you've kind of seen lots of different plays because and you'll get references and so on. But we sometimes think in the way that we can sort of like read a play and we can add that to our memory bank. And I think that there's a lot of missing that's going on, and we're sort of missing out the missing bits.
Yes, in the sense that the missing bits that we're missing on are the bits that are missing forever, as opposed to, but we're getting all the stuff that we get. Because, you know, in theory, anyone can, you know, now go to our, you know, playlists and go through every single play that we've read or produced, you know, full cast versions of, and that will increase more over time so that, yeah, it will become a practical viewing experience. I do wonder it's not so true anymore, but there used to be a time when there were ITV households and BBC households, and people would only watch one or the other, unless it was a really big show. And they would occasionally deign to go to the other channel because of perceptions of, especially class perceptions of what kind of television company you'd watch. And I wonder if maybe there was something in play there. Home teams.
Yeah. And also geographically, if you know, where you live, it's easier to go to, you know, and you like that particular company. I think sometimes, I wonder if sometimes the arguments about repertory style can sometimes be slightly overstated, and that I think what you kind of want in a repertory is a nice range of different stuff so that you can please lots of different people and people don't get bored.
Yeah.
And so I think sometimes we can maybe be slightly overdetermined in the way that we talk about a certain company. This company did this particular thing, and I think there's a certain amount of sort of slippage between things. But I do think that, you know, certainly there are particular, if you want to see, you know, Edward Allen, then you have to go to where Edward Allen is performing, you know, or if you want to see a particular, you know, Armin or whoever, you know, you have to go to that place, and there are particular aspects, and there are of course particular distinct things about plays in the different repertories. So I can totally buy that there are some people and they stick to one playhouse and that's basically where they go. I could buy maybe that there's somebody who really likes a particular company and they follow that company around, and if it moves then they move. I could totally see that. I can also see that there are some people who are picking and choosing and they're going maybe north of the river, south of the, it's going to depend on lots of different things.
What's the whisper network for these plays? What's the word on the street? How does that circulate? Because I bet there'll be people sitting in, you know, taverns or whatever going, you know, definitely. Have you seen the latest one? You know, what's the new one like? Oh, it wasn't very good. You won't like it. You know.
Yeah.
That kind of conversation.
Definitely. Yeah, definitely. That's absolutely happening. And we get, you know, that news spreads. And I think if something does well, that spreads very quickly. And the thing is, as soon as that's got attention, it kind of guarantees more attention, which I think is probably how something like Game of Chess happens, where, you know, it's like it snowballs, doesn't it? Somebody sees it, somebody else sees it. So then it becomes something that you end up having to see sort of regardless, because you need to know what the bloody hell everyone's on about.
Yes, and especially with that, there's a time pressure because everyone's going, that's going to get banned any second now, isn't it? We better go today, otherwise we'll not see it. You know, that's hence the fact that it has a 9 days run and a continuous run, which is pretty much unheard of. And lo and behold, really, it was indeed taken down very, very quickly.
Yeah, exactly. So I think there's a buzz. I think that's true of the Comedy of Humours, that evidently has a buzz. And that's partly why Chamberlain goes to steer. He's like, I want to know what people are on about. And he's a kind of newsmonger. That's sort of his job. His job is basically seeing stuff in London, not necessarily plays, but just doing stuff and then telling his mates on the continent. Mm. On mainland Europe, I should say, shouldn't I? We're all on the continent, but never mind. And that's, you know, that's the framework for him. He goes in thinking, well, everyone likes, and he either goes in thinking, everyone likes this, I bet it's rubbish, and maybe, you know, it becomes self-affirming, or he goes in with high expectations and is disappointed. And, you know, there are different ways it could work, but
it might have just been rubbish that night. That's the other thing. You know, different performances are going to come up with.
And it might have been flat. And the other thing is, just because people, just because you've got a full house, it doesn't mean that people like it.
No, You can have a really disastrous full house, and sometimes you can have a very empty house and they absolutely adore it. I mean, sometimes you have plays where, you know, you're looking at the takings in Henslow going, well, it's continually not selling well, but I'm assuming it's actually gone down well, but word of mouth isn't working. And so it never lifts.
Yeah, and there's also that sense that, you know, there's something that happens with something like Dr. Faustus. Some of the return to Dr. Faustus are almost comical, but, you know, presumably they have to put something on, and they're like, well, what the hell will we do? Well, you know, maybe you don't want to waste, you know, something that's really, you've got plans in a sense for something if it's new or if it's really good and you're thinking about, or you might not have that something available. So there's a certain extent with the repertory, and perhaps especially at this time, because they've got a relatively small number of plays, any given company. Whereas, as I say, King's Men, they potentially got a really very, very big catalogue because they can draw on 30 plus years. You know, they can go back to when they were the Chamberlain's Men and they've still got some of those plays. But if you're, say, the Admiral's Men, you don't have a massive one, so you kind of just you're stuck. You know, you've got to do something with this play, and you might say, well, I can't do that play because I've got a plan for it. You know, this play is a good play in a sense, but I can't put it on all the time, otherwise people will stop going and it'll age or it'll go stale.
The actors are sick and tired of doing it.
Yeah, exactly, they're fed up. You know, so you go, well, we're gonna have to put something on, because you can't, you know, they don't just go, oh, we're not going to bother putting something on today, we'll just go home. So they put on something, and sometimes people just don't want to see what that is. Oh, Faustus again, I've seen, you know, come on. But they've got to put it on, because that's what they've got, that's their job. Otherwise, they don't really exist.
There are a few days in Henslow that aren't Sundays that seem to have, there are the occasional gap days. I'm just wondering whether there's specific, you know, things happening.
Maybe, and we don't know.
Yeah, because I just wonder, you know, oh, someone's hired it to do something else that day, or, you know, they're cleaning the gutters.
There must have been things that disrupted. Obviously, there are plague and various other big things. There must have been other smaller things. But I just mean, as a general principle, I can't be bothered, work. You have to do it. You know, maybe there's something that stops you, your actors are sick or whatever. But you know, if you don't really have anything good to put on, you still kind of largely, mostly, you've got to do it. And most of the time they were playing to theatres that were not full. I mean, how empty, it's not quite clear, but sometimes probably, you know, well, certainly not full. I mean, that's, again, it's not normative that it's a full house, and that makes sense. But again, it's hard to shake the idea that we have that people are going to packed theatres in this, but that's often not the case with theatre, and the audience is part of the whole thing. So again, a question I'm interested in addressing, and something like Dr. Faustus is an interesting one, is what's that play like in front of a really packed audience, and what's it like when there's hardly anyone there? And Henslow gives us some indication of when that happens, because we can see his box office takings.
It's that thing. They're all matinees. which are never, you know, in modern theatre, not necessarily the most dynamic of audiences. And you know, yeah. thing, if it's raining and it's not a very full house, and it's probably quite likely to be raining, and you know, or cold or miserable, and the kind of slow houses, the slow days, the just doing the, and that's the difference between the professional and the amateur. You know, doing the show when you really don't want to do it, and the audience don't want you to do it either. And of course, we do have accounts of the audiences explicitly telling the actors that they don't want that play today. Thank you very much. We'd like the Merry Milkmaids, please.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. you know, so there's all those sort of irregularities or oddities or things that don't fully fit into the picture because they make it seem less good in some ways. Mm-hmm. You know, we want it all to be really good in lots of ways. And it, you know, probably a lot of people came away from the theatre and were just like, you know, that's probably what happens quite a lot of the time. And that's
better last week.
Yeah, yeah. And that's sort of okay, you know, because they're not coming away saying theatre is terrible, banned theatre, where you've got a problem. Mm. As long as they're not absolutely, you know, and even then, if they hate something, that can be publicity, can't it? I mean, you know.
Well, it's the Mary Whitehouse effect, isn't it? You know, sometimes you need a good rampant Puritan to actually drum up people going, oh, is it really that bad? Oh,
yeah, exactly. Yeah,
I've heard this place is full of sin. Could I come in?
And certainly we know also from the way that plays are printed that failure is very marketable. You know, it's really not that uncommon. The Knights of the Bend and Pestle is a good example for a play to be printed with an explicit acknowledgement, explicit and, you know, presumably not entirely necessary acknowledgement of its purported failure, where you could just do the play and say, here's a good play to read. But there's a sort of sense of, you know, there's something to be made of the fact that it was, that it failed in some way. Sejanus is another one, you know, the Faithful Shepherdess, quite a lot of these plays. Some of them find success later, but there's something marketable about the failure. You can spin all kinds of things.
Or the beef, you know, the question, you know, with the wars of the theatres, you know, the question of how artificial is this perceived war that's going on? Is this actually just a number of people just slinging mud for this fact that it creates good box office? Which reminds you of sort of musicians today who you're going, is this argument you're having on Twitter with this person real, or is this actually just a very, very cunning marketing ploy?
And again, going back to a sort of assumption that I think is a sort of solid assumption, is that they have to make money. That's the thing, isn't it? That is ultimately what they have to do. And they make that presumably in some broad sense by entertaining people, whatever that means. But they have to make money. If they don't make money, they don't have jobs. Henslow is a kind of, effectively, he's an administrator, isn't he? His job is to sort of administrate things and to record things, and what his documents leave to us are financial records. And if the whole thing bombs, then it can't exist. So, you know, that is a thing that they have to think about. That is a key part of what they have to do, or it's just not working.
Well, that's why we sort of see these not quite sequelitis, but we certainly see plays that are riffing on a popular success. We were just talking about humorous plays. You know, clearly there's a thing of, this has been massively successful. Could you go off and write some more like this? Yes, of course I can. And some of them are better than others. There's that sense of writing to order of, okay, well, maybe history plays have gone a little out of fashion. Could, you know, people are starting to spoof things as well. There's a lot more spoofery, or at least backhandedness, about certain things that were popular 5-10 years ago, going on in text as well. So you're sort of going, well, this is a bit out. So if we're going to do a history, you know, we need to do something a bit different with it. And, you know, tragedy sort of ebbs and flows over time. You have big explosions and then it damping down. And
I mean, you can sort of see where Tamburlaine starts to become kind of old news, and that's quite exciting because we've got the bit where it was really, you know, where it was really big news. But we can sort of see that it becomes an old play, and it becomes a play that is seen to be old-fashioned in time and becomes sort of mockable or spoofable. on those terms. And it's interesting to see this thing, which is often kind of viewed as being sort of on the sort of frontier of this kind of early modern professional theatre as we know it, in a relatively short space. Not, you know, it's not decades, it's probably under 10, it's 10 years or so, becoming something that is old hat. And that, you know, that's part of the process, isn't it? But then some of these things come back again, which is also sort of interesting. You know, something, it's not inevitable. It's not a straightforward process where you just age out and that's it, that you're toast. You know, some things come back. They seem to have had their moment, but then, you know, they return in some way. Not so much necessarily Tamburlaine, but that does happen with other players, and things which supposedly failed at one point. I mean, there's a little anecdote about the White Devil, because the White Devil's printed, and Webster says it didn't go down very well. He blames the audience, and he blames, you know, that he said it lacked a full and understanding auditory and so on. And then later on, there's an account in the 1630s of someone, I forget exactly who, saying, "Oh, the White Devil, not a very good text to read, but bloody hell, really good play to watch in the theatre." So you've got this real sort of kind of reversal that's taken place.
Again, in modern times, sort of parallels, I'm thinking about, you know, genre films, you know, things like horror, where there are clear cycles where a subgenre of horror will have its day, and then it will get spoofed, and then it will die, and then 10 years later, it starts cropping back up again in a slightly different way. I mean, you look at something like Spanish Tragedy, where you get explicitly, you get Geronimo, which is explicitly a spoof. It may be built on the ashes of the play Spanish Tragedy was a sequel to, but, you know, it is a spoof. And it's actually quite difficult, having done Geronimo twice, it's slightly difficult going back to Spanish Tragedy, because it has been spoofed quite well, and Geronimo's character has been buffooned in a way that makes the performance of Spanish Tragedy slightly difficult to take, because it is a bit excessive, and that's really interesting. You know, in that cycle of a little over 10 years, the play going from being the hottest thing to getting revivals, and at the same time as being revived, being really quite mercilessly torn apart. I think Geronimo is a really good play, actually. Okay. I think one line aside, it is absolutely excellent as a piece of entertainment.
And there are weird things that go on, aren't there, in the sense that, I mean, what's going on that makes people want to produce and watch film and TV shows about chefs? But you've got, what is it, The Bear is a TV show about a chef who, you know, goes into a sandwich restaurant and so forth. The Menu is a film. I don't quite know. Boiling Point is, for some reason, in the last year, there've been like a little mini explosion of dramas, not, you know, about chef people, you know, and I don't know what the hell's going on there, but something's happened. You know, this isn't a coordinated thing, but for some reason that, and you get that kind of thing all the time in the early modern period, where you get these little pockets, something's happening. It's not clear. I mean, this isn't clear to me exactly what's happened here, you know, and they speak to each other, and sometimes it'll be deliberate kind of reference, and sometimes it'll just be, I don't know, there's something culturally going on that is kind of and a way of speaking about it, or a way of doing it, is by channeling it into this particular sort of mode. But we can see those kinds of things. I haven't actually watched any of them, but I've no idea what's going on with these things. But it seems so interesting to me that, you know, in the space of a year or two, you know, you get three, and I'm sure that they're all very different and all the rest of it, but what's all that about? And you can see there's little bits and pieces where, you know, you get a bunch of plays that are about, you know, French doctors or whatever, and you're like, what the hell's going on with the French doctors? But something's happening there, you know?
Yeah, and it's not always the same company, so it's not like that guy can do a really good Frenchman.
Or maybe that guy can do a really good Frenchman. Can you do a really good Frenchman? Have a go, you know? Yeah. And because that's people, you know, that's the thing. If you're a comp, if you're the Chamberlain's man and the Admiral's man, have got someone who does a really good Frenchman, and everyone's going on about a really good Frenchman, then you probably, well, can we do a good Frenchman, or can we do a good Spaniard or something? You know, but there's that kind of that kind of thing that sort of might happen. But it's not always, sometimes it's legible and you can see it in sort of commercial terms and you can say, oh, okay, so they've probably seen this and they want their own version or whatever. I think that's absolutely right. And sometimes I think it's just a weird kind of confluence of stuff. It's not entirely obvious to me why exactly it's happening, but it's there. And it just is. And that's when you've got these three shows about chefs. Well, there you go. Don't know what it is, but it's there.
Yeah, I wonder if it's a sort of nostalgia tipping point, because there's always a point when, you know, someone comes through and they're all doing the 80s, or they're all doing the 70s, or they're all doing, you know, and they're because that's when they were young, and and that's their biggest influence, and you can see it in the work. And whether there's something there that could that feeds. I mean, there's certainly, we've got plenty of people rewriting, explicitly rewriting older texts and giving it a new modern spin. There's definitely someone we could probably call the reboot guy, but that's for another room and a different conversation. We have sadly really run out of time. We could probably do this all day, but I think we had better wrap up while we're still fresh. Thank you so much for all of this. This has been a really enjoyable discussion. I hope the listeners enjoy it as well. Do you have any plugs or anything you'd like to say to close us off?
I think I've plugged all of my stuff, so careful listeners will listen through for the mid-program plug. But thanks very much for having me on. It's been really lovely.
Well, all of the plays we've referenced, pretty much all of the plays we've referenced, are available on either the YouTube channel or on the podcast. I will endeavour to put some helpful links in the show description. Otherwise, just have a hunt. You know, Google. That's what it's for. It's a search engine. It finds things. To put the title in and or beyond into the search description, and you will probably find the things. And there are handy playlists of stuff that we've done, so that you can, if you want, just put them on and just let them wash over you, and as time goes on, for those listening in the far future, they get better the more times we do them. So if you're listening to this when this goes out, there's some of this stuff might be a bit shonky around the edges, but if you're listening in the far distant future, you'll be able to see it in super deluxe high definition, beam straight into your brain. All that remains to thank my guest Owen for joining me. Thank you very much, and goodbye.